A few years ago, when our children were younger, my wife and I took them to meet Dr. and Mrs. Din. Dr. and Mrs. Din lived in their lovely old Georgian home on the Norfolk-Suffolk border. Arthur and Helen Din were old friends of my parents. Sadly, they're no longer with us. And they were as delightfully quaint a couple as you could ever hope to meet. To have tea with Arthur and Helen felt like being transported into the world of Charles Dickens. The four of us sat with them at a large round table covered in a white linen cloth in a dark panelled dining room. We drank tea from a silver teapot. We ate cake and cucumber sandwiches and made polite conversation with our hosts. Helen had a unique way of saying, oh. It was never just, oh, more like, oh. And it was her kindly and frequent concerned response to almost anything you'd say. Oh. We'd sometimes told our children about this over the years, for they never really believed it till they heard it for themselves. It was almost worth the journey from Kent to Norfolk just to hear Helen say, oh. She told us while we were there of a time when she and Arthur had gone to the theatre in Norwich. Arthur, who was driving, wanted to park at a distance and walk to the theatre. Helen said she was quite sure that that was unnecessary and that there would be a parking space near to the theatre. Her view prevailed, but no space was found. And as they circled round and round and 7:30 drew nearer, there was a certain silence in the car until Helen was heard to say, I've done wrong. Oh, I've done wrong. And Arthur replied, I think you have. Oh, I've done wrong. Well, a memorable event, but not one of earth-shattering significance, I suppose. But that phrase of Helen's is one I've often come back to, I've done wrong. Because at a deeper level, there is so much that has gone wrong in our world, so that only an ostrich with its head well buried in the sand would deny it. And in a sense, that was always so, but I think as 2017 draws to a close, it is somehow easier for people to agree that all in this world is not as it should be. Happy headlines are a rarity, and optimism and hope are in short supply. Now, the Gospel of John, from which Anna read just now, enables us to understand what it is that has gone wrong with our world. John's way of putting it is to say that the world is in darkness. And he has a simple but penetrating explanation of why darkness and decay so often seem to dominate in our world. He tells us that God is light, and that if we turn from him as we have done, and as our society seems to want to do more and more, we separate ourselves from the source of everything that is good and wholesome and true. The God who made us has only to be left out of our picture and pushed to the side or out of the back door for other things that are less desirable by far to make their way in. And the way is then open for deep and lasting damage to be done to relationships at every level. For there to be a threat of war, not just between states, as might be between America and North Korea, but war within societies, war within neighborhoods, war even within families and within homes. And it may help if we think of it in terms of vertical and horizontal relationships. We are surrounded, are we not, by damaged relationships at the horizontal level, between people, between peoples. But what we may not have realized is the damage to the vertical relationship is the underlying cause in every case. If God is light, then to turn from him can only mean that we head out into darkness and decay. But if the world is full of darkness, John has a second and a sobering point, which is that the world prefers darkness. And we read in these words of John that light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil. When I was an impoverished theological student, I had no spare cash at all, certainly none to pay for holidays, but I did have kind and generous friends. And they used to take me with them every year to Scotland. Their son was a good friend of mine, which is why I was always included in the family holiday. And I remember once stopping off with David in Fort William on the way to the northwest to Scotland and looking in a small supermarket for some port. A bottle of port was to be my own very generous contribution to the two-week holiday. Eventually, I found some, and I called out to David, who was over on the other side. David, there's some Portuguese port over here. Looks nice. And back came the reply, Giles, all port is Portuguese port. That's why it's called port. And I laughed, and I said, oh, stupid of me, do you know, I'd never realized that. Except that that's not what I said. What I actually did was to splutter and say, well, yes, of course, I mean, I know that, but I just mean that this particular port looks rather nice. He wasn't convinced, nor, I think, were the other shoppers, as were rather obvious from the glances that they exchanged. We don't like being shown up, do we? I know I don't. We don't like being exposed, even if nothing more serious than our ignorance at a particular point is the issue. And what the Apostle John tells us here is harder hitting than that. He tells us that what we like to hide is not just ignorance, but the deeper-seated flaws in our character, from which come words and attitudes and actions of which we should be ashamed. But all too often we're not, and we wriggle. And we say things like, well, I don't know what came over me, when, in all honesty, probably nothing came over me. Almost certainly whatever it was welled up from inside me and burst its banks. We'd all like to think, wouldn't we, that we are essentially okay people, that we are by nature lovers of what is good and wholesome and true. As the Times columnist Matthew Paris, for instance, recently argued in his column, here's what he said, I quote, mankind is imbued with an instinctive desire to find and cleave to what is right. It is good to be alive, and people mostly live to be good. But John says, sadly, it's not as easy as that. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian writer and survivor and chronicler of the Gulag, put it this way, again I quote, if only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But, he says, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart? The world is in darkness, according to the Apostle John, because what we do is to turn from the light rather than to the light. So on that first Christmas day 2,000 years ago, the light came into the world. But far from welcoming it, we ended up by rising up and extinguishing it. I wonder whether it's ever seemed strange to you that Jesus Christ, of all people who've lived on this earth, should be thrown out, abandoned, and crucified. And the cross of Christ stands at one level as a terrible indictment of our human nature. It tells us that we are rebels in God's world. That when he came to live among us, we didn't want to know. And we chose instead to crucify our Maker. Now that being so, what John goes on to tell us in these paragraphs is a miracle of grace and loveliness. He tells us that this is this very same world, in all its lostness and its confusion, its rebellion and its distress, this is the very world that God has loved. And there it is in black and white in front of us. God loved the world. Perhaps the most famous verse in the Bible, John chapter 3, verse 16. God loved the world. And if it sounds strange to put that in the past tense, it isn't really so. It is no less true, of course, that he loves the world today. But to say that God loved the world is to anchor that love in historical reality. And it's to remove from it every hint of sickly sentimentality of the kind that can sometimes surface in the Christmas season. God loved the world. Now, the historicity of Christian faith is essential to its integrity and to its relevance. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. And the one who is earlier described in John's Gospel as the Word of God, the one through whom God speaks to us, became flesh and dwelt and lived among us. And we, says John, we who were there at the time, He and his friends, we saw his glory, he says, glory as of the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. It's a lovely summary statement of Jesus and who he was and what he was. The glory of the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. If you haven't read one of the gospel records since becoming an adult, why not resolve this Christmas time to do so and consider for yourself the glory, the wonder of this extraordinary human being. For the Son of God, just to enter our messy world is strange enough. But for him to do so, knowing full well that we wouldn't tolerate his being here, well, now that cries out for explanation. And John gives us that explanation. It comes in verse 17. God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. When friends of mine were at an early stage of family life, they lived for a few years out in Singapore. Richard was busy in the financial world, and Caroline was extremely busy looking after her small children. They lived in a pleasant ground floor apartment, which opened out into a sheltered enclosed courtyard, which they shared with neighbouring flats, and in the centre of the courtyard was a swimming pool. There was a glass wall at the back of this flat, looking out onto the courtyard. And when Caroline suddenly realised that her two-year-old was not in the flat and might even now be drowning in the pool, she went straight through the glass wall. She doesn't remember doing so, but the evidence of broken glass all around was incontrovertible. She went so fast that she did herself no harm, that the same could not be said of the wall. Toddler Felix was, in fact, okay, and not drowning in the pool. But at the thought that he was in danger, maternal instinct instantly took over and all caution was thrown to the winds. And that a young mother should love her child so much, wonderful as it is really no great surprise to us. But that the God to whom we have at best paid faint respect should love us to the extent of laying down his life for us. Now that really should take our breath away. The glass wall in Singapore was wrecked, but no harm came to the mother as she went about her child's rescue. But the rescue, what John calls the salvation that God the Father has undertaken, involved the death of his one and only Son. God so loved that he gave. And so the cross of Jesus is not only, not even principally, an indication of our warped human nature. It is also, and more wonderfully, the demonstration for all time of the deep, the powerful, the sacrificial love of God. God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but shall have eternal life. And if we ask what it means to believe in this Jesus who came into our world, it does not mean, as is sometimes said, to take a leap in the dark. It actually means the opposite of that. It's about coming out into the light. As John says, everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear their deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light. So once again, this Christmas time, that is the choice with which the Christian narrative presents us. It is so much more than a pretty story about angels and shepherds and wise men bringing gifts from afar. It asks us to consider carefully which way we are heading in life. And it invites us to take a calculated risk, to do the uncomfortable thing, to leave the darkness behind, to come out of it, and to come out into the light, and to put our trust wholly and unreservedly in Jesus Christ, and to live from now on with him, and not ourselves, as the center of our world.